Okay. I'd like to move forward.
I move approval of the minutes of August 11th and October 27th.
Oh, okay.
All right, do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Bob. Our board member Gunther. Got to get back in my formal name. Any discussion?
In my review, I noticed I didn't have a...
Can you use the microphone, please?
I remember talking with the policy committee and asking Adrian if it would be possible for an update, a briefing on the type N issue, and I don't see that in here.
You mean the back and forth that you did with him is not reflected in the minutes?
Yes. And
And which minutes are those? The August 11th minutes, I assume.
It was the,
I assume that's in the August 11th minutes.
Yes.
Specifically.
Yes. Under the TFW Policy Committee's work priorities. I think that's when we talked about it. I just wanted to note that it was missing.
So I can go back and add it.
Okay.
So. Or we can take note that it will at some point be taken care of.
Okay.
Either we note it in the minutes, I'll have to go back and make that reflection.
So what do we do in this case? Do we actually postpone amending the minutes? Okay, so to the motion presenter, would you take a friendly amendment to just...
Well, let me suggest this. Yeah. Why not just have the minutes of today reflect this comment and it is duly noted?
That's fine.
Is the seconder okay with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
So we would approve these and your comment that this additional discussion occurred is now in the minutes of today, so we don't have to put off the document.
Okay, and I think with that my reflection is that Adrian said that we would get a briefing on the type N issue and history at some point. It doesn't have to be today, of course.
Okay. So, any other discussion from other board members, please? On approval of both the October 27th and August 11th minutes, as suggested, will be amended in today's minutes. Okay. Everybody in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion is passed. Okay, I give my brief few minutes as chair. So the first thing I want to do is, it's on a sad note. Those of you who have worked in the horse practices arena for some time, Sherry Fox passed away recently. She's a former board member, and she was also the policy lead for the Washington Farm Forestry Association for some time, and really did a lot of service towards moving small forest landowner issues forward. So I would just ask for a moment of silence as we think of her. Thank you. Other items I'd like to talk about just briefly. As you know, we've had a large wildfire season this year. I want to thank landowners in particular, contract loggers, small forest landowners. I put out a call in August to do a couple of things. One is to reduce the number of FPAs. we were down to less than half of our staff to process forced practice applications during that time. And we really needed people to focus on a job at hand, which was to put out fires during that season and not have the need to be processing applications at the same time to the extent that it was possible. So I want to thank you, those of you who were able to pull back and wait until fire season was over when people were back in the office and able to move applications forward. I also want to thank TFW partners, particularly up in the Northeast region, for helping DNR process all the timber salvage applications that took place right after wildfire season. That we experienced two different workload stresses there. One was when everybody was out fighting fire, fewer people at home to actually do the application processing, and then second, an increased effort right after fire to process timber salvage in the burned areas. So I want to thank everybody for their help on that. We did a couple other things that were tried to relieve the workload. We quit processing water type moss during that period. And we have rescinded that now. We also suggested to some of our regions that if they really needed to, they could approve applications, but they could be further conditioned within 60 days if they weren't processed to the extent necessary. So those were things we did during wildfire season to keep things going. In your packets, if they're not in there now, they will be before the end of the day. We have a one-pager on our budget submittal to the legislature for the supplemental budget. And I want to call your attention to three different items in there. One is a wildfire supplemental budget request. I won't talk in detail, but if you would like more detail on that at the next board meeting, I can have one of our wildfire people come and talk to you about it. And there's also an additional supplemental request for geologic resources, including LIDAR, and that's also in the package. And finally, for forced practices, we're asking for spending authority to spend a fund balance in the forest and fish support account. We've got a fund balance that we hope will help make ends meet in the short term. As you know, forced practices took a 30% hit on budget in the 09-11 biennium. We have not recovered from that hit from an operations standpoint. And however, as the recession has, as we have come out of the recession, we've had a 36% increase in workload. So we are still trying to operate on a reduced staffing level. I want to point out a few staffing changes that has occurred. As you know, Chris Hanlonmeyer, the former division manager for forced practices, left the agency in August or so. So now we have Mark Engel as acting division manager. We're actively seeking a new division manager. And that process is moving forward. And while Mark is doing acting division manager duties, Jim Herring is, we brought him in from the South Puget Sound region to run the policy section for us. So we appreciate that work. I wanted to note, she will be surprised by this, but we have a staff person who, this is probably her last forced practices board meeting.
My last.
Who knew?
Gretchen, would you stand up?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Gretchen is our editor-in-chief on things like board manuals.
And, don't say that today.
And she is going to be sorely missed when she retires at the end of December. Another note I wanted to make is, as you know, the Commissioner of Public Lands received a letter from the Federal Services regarding water typing in the first week of July. We have responded to that letter, and we are doing our darndest to rebuild some relationships with the Federal Services to make things go better as we move forward on our ACP. So, next agenda item is public comment. I just want to remind everybody that the purpose of the afternoon public comment period is for those that can't be here this morning. Okay, so what I'd like to do today is I'd like people to keep their comments to about 3 minutes. And the first person up, calling Mark Goodyear from the United Columbia Upper Tribes. Upper Columbia United Tribes. Get that right, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Board. My comments are specific to the field trip that we all got to go on together. And first of all, I'd just like to say that I thought it was a great field trip. I really appreciated that you all were able to come out in the field, see some of the stuff that we do in the field and some of the determinations we make and learn from that. So I appreciated you guys being out there, and I thought it was a great field trip. I do have just a little bit of feedback. You know, that you might have been able to sense a little bit of frustration on my part in that the concept behind the field trip was to look and see how we're currently doing things as it relates to FN break determinations and off-channel habitat. And one of the components, at least from my perspective, that was missing is we heard quite extensively from landowners and from DNR, which was great, and I do understand why that format was chosen. But there also are Department of Ecology, WDFW, and affected tribes that participate in these ID teams. And at least from my perspective, maybe have a little bit different perspective on how things are currently being done in the field. And so I just wanted to share a little bit of that. But I also want to make a request in that I only have 3 minutes now, and it's probably going to be really rushed, and I probably won't be able to get everything out. I think it would behoove this group to have an opportunity in the future to hear from those other participants and ID teams to help further this discussion. I think there's a lot of value in hearing from them. So with that being said, I just wanted to specifically address a few things that I heard out there. One is on the FN break determination, I thought that was a great site. We got to see a dry channel that transitioned into a wet channel that had fish. I think that was great for conversation. Some of the things that we heard out there, though, that I do have maybe take a little issue with is the use of electrofishing and our assurance that that is going to be an effective tool in determining the extent of fish habitat. And that most likely, if you go on a single pass survey, you are going to find fish if they're present in that system. And at least from our experience in Eastern Washington tribes, we have a lot of seasonal variability with our fish species. And so, unfortunately, a single pass survey during the protocol survey window doesn't always adequately reflect the extent of fish habitat because of what I just said, seasonal variability. And then also the timing windows for those protocol surveys, from my understanding, were developed more specific to west side species and the most likelihood that they'd be in a system at that given time. On, again, in Eastern Washington, that, at least from our perspective, isn't the appropriate window for protocol surveys. We have fish that aren't present in those windows that are, if you survey them, for example, later in the fall or earlier in the spring. So I just wanted to make those points. And then to the off-channel habitat site that we stopped at, again, I thought that was actually a great example of, you know, we walked up to it, and I think the group made it appear that that was a fairly easy decision to make, but I think that was a great example of the type of location that we actually get into conflicts in the field. And I would argue that the reason we get into those conflicts is because the current rule language is not solid enough, and it leaves enough ambiguity that it leads to debates out in the field. So on that site, I think the key thing that I heard, you know, there was starting to be a little rumbling from the crowd whether or not they agreed with that determination on where you would put that flag for that off-channel habitat. And one of the responses from one of the DNR staff was, well, there's a small channel over on that far side, so that helped them in their decision making. And I would just flag that there's often times where there isn't a small channel on that far side, and that you're looking just at that vegetation and at that elevation. And I think we could add some more tools. We don't need to change the rule per se, but we need to add the tools for the reviewers to make that repeatable and enforceable determination on off-channel habitat.
You
done? I got lots more, but I'm done for now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ken Miller, Washington Farm Forestry Association.
Good morning, Chairman Bernath and members of the board. I'm Ken Miller, a longtime advocate for small forest landowners that also attended the October 27th field tour. I found it both educational and intimidating from a small landowner perspective. While the focus was on the complexities of the stream typing issues debated for the last 15 years by all the folks behind me, I'd like to share what I saw as a small landowner. The first stop was in the middle of a small fish channel that apparently rarely ever had running water. I imagine this being my 40-acre parcel with a good crop of trees, where I would still have to leave a football field length swath of trees through the middle of my parcel to protect fish, just as I would have to do if this were a very large stream with water and real fish. From where we were standing at this stop, we couldn't even see the outer edge of a buffer I would be required to leave. Hundreds of my crop trees in the outer portions of these buffers would have had to been left to provide potential large woody debris for this narrow stream and provide shade, summer shade, for the water in this dry stream bed. We subsequently stopped at a natural rock barrier that would stop the migrating salmons that small forest landowners very definitely wanted to help in forest and fish. Yet this already overly wide buffer continued further upstream. Even further up than even narrower stream, near the perennially debated breakpoint between fish and non-fish, the complex electrofishing discussion continued, as if the exact dividing line meant the one-size-fits-all buffer would suddenly go to no protection, where an error in the exact breakpoint might actually make a difference to fish or fish habitat. In fact, the upstream portion of this very tiny stream without fish would still have a buffer, albeit a narrower buffer, for at least another 300 feet upstream. Critters are always protected, but my economic viability to keep practicing forestry on my land would be negatively impacted by retaining oversized fish buffers even further upstream. Our last stop got even more wonkish and complex, as I think Mark was saying. Imagine being a small landowner harvesting once in a lifetime. How many of you walked away thinking you could actually find the appropriate starting point to begin measuring whatever buffer is required beyond that complex point on the ground? Thank you, as Mark said, for letting us join you on the field trip. A former board member wisely advocated frequently getting out into the woods where the trees can do the talking. How else can you have the perspective needed to ultimately referee the long-standing debates coming from TFW policy? Thank you very much.
Chris Mendoza.
Good morning, board members. Thank you for the time to testify. My name is Chris Mendoza. I represent the Conservation Caucus. This morning, I wanted to specifically address one of the board motions from August that you just approved on addressing the highlighted sections of Board Manual 16 that I submitted in August, specifically relating to some of what board member Dave Summers referred to as emphasis language, so I'll just leave it at that.
Chris, do you want to wait until we actually do public comment on Board Manual 16 for this?
Well, it's up to the board. I looked at the schedule, and given the time limitations on the morning and afternoon, I was also going to speak to another issue during that time slot. So,
okay.
I thought I'd get this out of the way since it was part of the minutes. That's
okay.
So having gone through that with DNR staff, some of those words, the emphasis words, were retained just as an update to what happened to the board since you made the motion. However, we still respectfully disagree with DNR staff considering the use of emphasis language throughout board manual based on whether it's too prescriptive or rule-like. Having served on other board manual committees for road construction and dish passage most recently in 2013, and reviewed the language in those board manuals, and I would encourage board members to do so, there's similar language in other board manuals that speak to should consider versus may consider and other types of emphasis language. So that interpretation based on my review of those board manuals is inconsistent. It's not applied across the board manual, so it doesn't support the notion that it's too rule-like or prescriptive. And finally, to make my time, I think a good example is language in the board manual that you've seen highlighted before, and I'll just read one paragraph. The initial language from the expert panel read, this is concerning delineating groundwater recharge areas of deep-seated landslides. When conditions warrant, excavation pits, driving probes, soil probes, drilling monitoring wells, et cetera, other methods and techniques should be considered in order to better characterize and reduce uncertainties about subsurface groundwater conditions where topographic indicators are inconclusive. In other words, if you're not really sure about looking at the surface of the ground, you should consider looking and using these other tools. So, as an example, that language was changed from when conditions warrant to, although rarely applied in a forest environment, and then struck out later was instead of should be considered in order to, he says, can better characterize. So in this way, the emphasis language actually changed the meaning and intent of that paragraph. When you put, although rarely applied in the forest environment, that if you're a reader of the board manual, you may think, well, geez, it's rarely applied, maybe I don't have to consider it. And since it doesn't say should consider, can better characterize. So I think these are examples of where, even if the interpretation of emphasis language, whether should or may be changed, in this case, as you can see, it actually changes the meaning of the paragraph, based on my opinion. So based on that,
summarize, please.
Yeah. So based on that. We still would support reinsertion of the expert panel's initial language in cases in the board manual. While we appreciate DNR's time to re-review that with us, changes weren't made. Again, we respectfully disagree with the interpretation of such language. Thank you for your time.
Holly Kuhn.
They need to be looking at the handout while
okay,
I speak. I'm referring to the handout. Thank you. I'm going to start with the LiDAR image on the front. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Bernath and members of the Forest Practices Board. For the record, my name is Holly Kuhn. I'm a small forest landowner, and I'm here today to ask you not to approve Board Manual Section 16 as written, as well as some other general comments, which is why I'm speaking now. I'm curious, have any of you spent 48 hours straight in moving, shin deep water, rain driving so hard your headlamp can't penetrate the dark, so if it weren't for remaining patches of snow to mark the banks, you'd have no idea where quicker, deeper water began? Have you smelled that flood smell as you hauled sandbags and dug trenches to reroute water around your home as a FEMA helicopter low flies overhead, or sent your child away to stay with relatives because sleeping with the window next to your bed wide open so you can hear the landslide coming seems okay to you for yourself, but not your child? Have you ever felt the ground shake and the too loud to scream roar of a massive landslide release and felt your heart stop in panic, only to start beating again as you realize it was across the valley and not overhead? Well, I have. So imagine how I felt when I first saw the LiDAR image of the two proposed North Zender timber sale units that got passed around to you just now. The one that shows each unit smack dab in the middle of its own deep-seated landslide above the home I describe above. Or how I felt when I obtained a copy of the North Zender FPA and saw nothing that acknowledged or accounted for the potential impacts of increased sedimentation, runoff, or mass wasting beyond the 50-acre boundary of each unit. If you look at that LiDAR map, you'll see the DNR legend of features that were considered important in the layout of the North Zender sale. Look again, and you'll see features I added, features that were not considered by the DNR. 20 single-family homes, a 400-student elementary school, and $200,000 worth of fish habitat improvements, mostly paid for by the DNR's own Family Forestry Fish Passages Program. Flip that handout over now, please. What you also don't see are the hundreds of cubic feet of gravel that have required dredging and removal, paid for by landowners, including myself, but originating barely outside the sale boundary and just downstream from the planned new road and bridge construction necessary to access the sale. But most importantly, what you still don't see is evidence of forest practice policies that are strong enough and clear enough to drive boots-on-the-ground procedures that prioritize public safety or protect the integrity of habitat and the complex field conditions found in situations like North Zender, which, I'm sorry, I can't imagine are all that uncommon. To meet those goals would require policy that employs the most up-to-date science available to pre-identify potential danger to public safety or public resources, and then use that science again to rule the danger out. What I see instead when I read the manual is a gosh gee, maybe, coulda, sorta, shoulda set of guidelines instead of rules that leaves individual field practitioners liable for decisions they must make on a case-by-case basis, absent procedural rules provided by policymakers who are supposed to be assuming the responsibility for precautionary approach at the governance level. Is this lack of precautionary policy what we would expect of other industries in other contexts? Is this what we expect of policymakers dealing with building and codes in earthquake zones or zoning regulations in thousand-year floodplains that, due to climate change, are turning out to be 10-year floodplains? Nope. We expect our policymakers to consider many stakeholders and many issues, but even in the absence of clear black and white or simple models, we also expect them to put public safety above any other consideration. As a member of the Forest Practices Board, why should you exempt yourself from this responsibility? In closing, I'd like you to flip that handout back over to the LiDAR image, please. Now imagine that you are me, looking at that picture, while someone reads you the following sentence from the memo on the cover of BM Section 16, and I quote, "Guidance for deep-seated landslide runout is not discussed because the complexity of movement and triggering mechanisms do not allow for simple predictive models." If you approve BM Section 16 as written, you are in fact declaring that because the model isn't simple enough for you, you are willing to abdicate your governance responsibility to protect public safety and assure wise use of tax dollars over to private watchdog groups and vigilant individual citizens. The policy you make will drive the practices on the ground that get the outcomes you choose, and I'm here today to ask you to choose human safety as your priority outcome. Please do not approve BM 16 as written. Thank you.
So I would ask public members who have signed up for public comment, if you, we do have a public comment period before we discuss the Board Manual 16, and this public comment is intended for other issues that we will not be taking action on. So as I call you out, would you please consider that? So Max Duncan,
Well, Honorable Chair, I'm also here to comment on the 16th. So what would you suggest? I drove 3 hours to get here. I spent the night in a hotel and I took work off. So I certainly want my input to be given. I'm willing to do whatever you you think is most appropriate.
If you can just wait a few minutes, we'll open up public comment specific to unstable slopes.
All right. I need to sign something.
Heather Swanson.
I'm in the same position as Mr. Duncan. Again, my concern is that with such a short time frame on the agenda for public comment, I've come a long way to give my comment, and I don't want to be limited because of time. So
I understand.
So would you prefer that I wait also?
Yes, please. Wyatt Goulding.
I'll go ahead. My comments follow up on Holly's, but they don't concern the board manual specifically. They're just on steep and unstable slope issues, so, and that's specific to Versailles and the regulatory practices with it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Ath and members of the board. My name is Wyatt Goulding. I was in the privilege of being counsel for Holly, Max, and the other landowners that live out in Whatcom County below the LIDAR, the map landslide on that LIDAR image that was passed around. So I just have a couple of comments related to that FPA and the approval that I want to stress here today. The first is that LIDAR is really critical, and this is an example you can see on the ground. It shows where the landslides were. You can see the runout. You can see slope failures around the landslides coming from DNR roads, inner gorge areas. And then our geologist pointed me to the top of those landslides where you can see what he called incipient headwall breaks, which shows that they're sharp edges, that there is ongoing movement that really presents a risk here. And so that LIDAR is terrific. I'm really glad DNR is getting more of it, and we ask that we get it, it's public, and we apply it in a reliable and precautionary manner. The second point I have is just to reflect on the testimony you heard from Holly and hear from others on that well-grounded, reasonable fear that people have that live out there. And that is a real thing. In the big picture, logging on potentially unstable slopes imposes real costs and imposes it really on rural Washingtonians, people who aren't often heard from. They're stuck with the risk. So we make the decisions here in Olympia at policy level. If it's private land, the logs go off to Asia, the profits go off to shareholders around the globe. But people living there are left with the risk, the potential damage, and even if there's not a slide, the fear that she spoke to. And so I'd like to echo her comments and ask the as we go forward today and in the future, you think about living below that slope and the level of regulatory precaution you would want if that was your home and your family. Thank you.
Peter Goldman.
Good morning, board members and Chair Burnett. My name is Peter Goldman. I'm the director of the Washington Forest Law Center. I'll be addressing Board Manual 16 during the second comment period, but in this general comment period, I'd like to recap from a higher level the long and slow road to reforming our forest practice rules so that these rules do not permit dangerous landslides to jeopardize public safety or rivers, streams, and public improvements. I urge the board to direct the board's adaptive management program to finally address in a comprehensive manner the inadequate rules, guidelines, screening, and enforcement policies governing these forest practices. The magnitude and frequency of storms ushered in by climate change cannot be ignored any longer. It was December 2007, and very heavy rains hit southwest Washington. Some said it was a 500-year storm, but most river and rain gauges pointed to something much lower recurrence interval. The massive rainstorm triggered 1,147 landslides within a 100 square mile area in western Lewis and Clallam County. After the storm, in the board, via the board's adaptive management program, with scarce state monies, the state launched a mass wasting effectiveness monitoring study, a multi-million dollar study that took a close look at whether the existing forest practice rules worked to prevent landslides. The results, released in April 2012, demonstrated that the rules were not working. Up to 41% of these 1,147 landslides initiated on slopes that were not, and I emphasize, not covered by existing rule, and thus they received no protection under the state forest practice rules. The logical conclusion from this one study is that the existing rules and regulations are under-inclusive, or that DNR's process for screening permits, applying conditions to them, or enforcing them on steep and unstable slopes was inadequate, or both. A year later, in January 2013, DNR released its own study, the Southern Willapa Hills Retrospective Study. Now that study analyzed a subset of 103 harvest-related landslides that occurred within the previously discussed study. DNR found in that study that 69% of those landslides initiated in areas not meeting the forest practice rules for logging on steep and unstable slopes. The study also found that 27% of these landslides initiated in places where there even had been geologic review or an approved watershed analysis prescription. Like the other study, this study demonstrates that DNR screening and enforcement procedures for potentially unstable slopes and landforms require significant improvement. Nothing, except the board manual we're discussing today, has come out of those two studies. Nothing. Yet. There's a lot of buzz around here today for good reason. It's because our forest practice regulatory system, which is supposed to be based on science and sound public policy, is failing public safety. The board and DNR not only have not responded to the science, but today the board is considering taking a step in the wrong direction by adopting something that might be unsound.
Can you summarize, please?
The public expects this board to act on this extremely important subject soon, and they also expect the board to follow the science and the precautionary principle. Please, let's follow the science and do our best to make public safety our highest priority.
You. Wayne O'Neill.
Chairman Burnett, members of the board, I'm Elaine O'Neill. I'm the executive director of the Washington Farm and Forestry Association. I'm going to move us back to the east side in Wildfire. But first, I want to thank you, Chairman Burnett, for recognizing Sherry Fox. It's been quite a blow to our community. The service is going to be November 21st, and the details are actually on our website, the Washington Farm and Forestry Association website. So I want to give the board a heads up and an acknowledgement of some of the work that's been ongoing. As you recall, we submitted a template proposal for West Side riparian zones last February, and we said at that time that we were working on an East Side alternative as well. What we have done is engaged Kramer Fish Science to evaluate the East Side riparian stand data to come up with a series of alternative prescriptions that are equal in overall effectiveness and yet meet that need as identified in the original Small Business Economic Impact Statement for reducing regulatory burden on small forest landowners. And given the wildfire situation this year, I think the need for this evaluation was brought home very clearly to me. Probably most of you do not realize this, but I actually did my master's thesis using a series of case studies to evaluate the economic impact of these rules on small forest landowners in eastern Washington. There was a corollary in the western Washington that was not done by me. I have to say I'm very sad to report that one of those landowner case studies completely burned out this year, including their beautiful home in the Okanagan complex. That's over 500 acres of timber and riparian zone at home that's gone. Another loss to substantial area of riparian zone due to fireline construction as part of their containment requirements on the Carpenter Fire Road, Carpenter Road fire in Stevens County. In that particular instance, it was timber only. No homes were affected. I have to say, both of these members have been severely affected. Both have deeply compelling stories, and we can expect to hear more of those stories. And collectively, they and other WFFA members on the east side see a need for reasonable solutions that address these kinds of wildfire risks and riparian protection collectively. My background is in science and in climate change, looking at the impacts of climate change on extreme events. And I have to say, whether these back-to-back extreme fire years are a result of climate change or the Pacific blob or some random chance, I think is largely irrelevant. When we talk about FireWise, we've always talked about protecting structures and human habitation. And we always say wildfire is not an if, it's a when. And I think, as we've seen in the past 2 years, that's true. The damage, the risks, they're very high, not only for people and structures, but also for the forests and for the riparian zones. So what we've done is to take a scientific examination of this, looking at a full suite of riparian data that's been collected by CEMER to assess the alternatives and try to come up with a strategy that we think will meet our needs and also address this larger risk. We're using, as I said, data by CEMER, and one more minute. Our next step is to develop the prescriptions and then work collectively to put together a template proposal. We anticipate presenting that in February, all going well. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mary Skirla.
Morning, board members. I'm taking you back to the October 27th field tour. Perhaps next time we could gather everyone's subject matter at the same time. The Conservation Caucus, whom I represent on the TFW Policy Committee, my name is Mary Skirla, very much appreciates the board's having taken the time to discuss stream typing and related issues in the field setting on October 27th. And I think a lot of us could see quite clearly that board members were energized and to ask thoughtful questions and really get into some of the issues that I think will be important for you all to have a deep understanding of by the time we get to some policy decisions next year. But we do have a couple of comments about the field tour as part of your debriefing, which you'll be having later on. First, I just want to acknowledge that habitat-based stream typing is our shared policy goal. I thought Mark Engel did a really good job of reviewing the history of the nuts and bolts of stream typing, and that the goal is to identify fish habitat, not simply fish presence, and ultimately to create highly accurate water type maps. An important goal of the current system and the typing review that we're engaged in at policy must be to ensure a reliable determination of fish habitat, notwithstanding variables that affect fish presence, as perceived through a single point in time survey. These variables include fluctuating water years, man-made barriers to fish presence, ephemeral natural barriers to fish distribution, and reduced present-day fish abundance. I also wanted to say that, as maybe it's self-evident, that the gray areas around electrofishing protocol surveys are going to be important. And we fully understand Chair Bernath's decision to focus on the fundamentals of stream typing on the field tour, shy away from those gray areas, but those are very clearly the trouble spots for policy and, by extension, this board. As we've testified previously, and as is clear from policy deliberations on stream typing, there are a number of concerns. And one of them has been raised previously today by Mark Godier, is the extent to which the current seasonal window for survey timing of March through July really provides adequately high confidence that surveys are being conducted only when fish are most likely to be present. Our technical advisors agree that with WDFW and the tribal biologists that Board Manual Section 13 needs clarification regarding early spring survey timing to recognize situations where the currently generally prescribed timing may not be appropriate. And we have several recommendations in that regard that I summarized in the memo. We also believe that additional clarifying guidance is needed about conditions under which electrofishing should generally be considered inappropriate, when flows are too high or too low, too turbid. high and low water temperatures and other instances. We also have some thoughts on water type modification forms, that where e-fishing surveys are conducted and relied upon to type streams for any FPA, it should be required to be memorialized in such a form. That the extent to which a water type modification is considered permanent needs to be clarified in the permanent rule and guidance, and that when streams depicted on DNR's water type maps as type N are confirmed by landowners to have type F physical characteristics when validating their water types, that this information should also be required to be submitted. It also goes without saying that there are also difficulties in implementation of off-channel habitat, and following up on Mark Godier's testimony, there is need to have guidance so that we don't have the kind of acrimonious debates that Mark is so well aware of.
Can you summarize, please?
Last but not least, on the RMAP checklist, we just want to take this opportunity to express our concern that the efficacy of the RMAP checklist approach from an impacts reduction and water quality standards attainment perspective is not currently known and should require some attention in the future. Thanks a lot.
Karen Fulger.
Good morning, Chair Bernath and members of the Forest Practices Board. My name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the Senior Forester for the Washington Forest Protection Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm also going to speak to the Forest Practices Board tour. WFPA and our member companies were very pleased to see that the board took the time to go out and actually look at stream typing processes as well as learn about our maps up close and personal, and we appreciate that, the time that you took for that process. We also believe, along with others, that it was a very good tour, very representative, I think, of what actually happens out in the field. And although there have been some concerns identified today, and I believe that there was probably some frustration from folks who weren't able to speak during the tour, those concerns we feel are necessary to take a look at, but also being looked at during the processes that policy is going through, looking at the matrix that Adrienne Miller is going to talk about a little bit later, to identify a science-based way to look at whether or not those concerns and those problems actually are occurring on a regular basis and what the solutions might be. One thing that I wanted to do is also call your attention to some additional information that really wasn't provided during the tour because you were outside and this is more paper, but I just wanted to remind you of the four goals of the Forest and Fish Report and the Habitat Conservation Plan. Certainly the ecological goals, which you took a look at during the process out in the looking at stream typing, but also the economic goal that is really important in maintaining a viable forest industry. Water typing, as it is practiced in Washington State now, is actually all three methods are based on fish use. And a discussion about which method actually, or which combination of methods actually provide highly accurate and effective water typing is a critical part of the discussion as we go forward in policy. The Habitat Conservation Plan and the Forest and Fish Report are also very much focused on fish populations, not individual fish. And there are three major objectives of water typing. One is a map system, secondly, that is highly precise, and third, that there's an equitable allocation of risk. Those three elements are critically important as we move forward through this process. So again, I just would like to thank you, appreciate the opportunity to speak today, but also to have Forest Practices Board members out in the woods. Thank you.
Kevin Godwood.
Good morning, Chairman Bernath and members of the board. My name is Kevin Godbout with the Weyerhaeuser Company. On your agenda today, you will be addressing several topics of interest. The big decision on Board Manual 16, you're going to recap the field trip focusing on fish use determination, and then a brief update on the Northern Spotted Owl status review. While you may or may not be making decisions on these items today, I thought I'd just remind you of the importance of, as you work through all these individual issues, trying to keep legislative intent in mind as you deliberate what to do. And I'm passing around page one of the Forest Practices Act, and it talks about legislative finding and declaration. I won't spend a whole lot of time reading it, but paragraph one of RCW 7609 basically says that, you know, at the end, you have to make decisions that, you know, coincident with the maintenance of a viable forest products industry, is important to afford protection to forest soils, fisheries, wildlife, water quality and quantity, air quality, recreation, and scenic beauty. In other words, it's a balancing act. And further in section three, it specifically addresses issues associated with mass earth movements, in which it says that the purpose of the interest of the state is to reduce the impact of mass earth movements. And while I think this is all important, it's important to keep, you know, legislative intent in mind, that there is no thumb on the scale in terms of things like spotted owls. Yeah, you can't really do whatever is necessary to prevent the extinction of the spotted owl. It's a balancing act. In terms of fish, it's not about providing the benefit of the doubt. It's a balancing act. And in terms of addressing unstable slopes, you know, the legislative intent is clear that you are to do and implement policies to reduce the impact from mass earth movements. It's not to take a precautionary approach. It's not to take a risk-free approach. It's to work on eliminating risk, but not to do it in a manner in which they are eliminated, that these landslides are naturally occurring and they will continue to occur. So I would just ask you to continue to keep in mind legislative intent, legislative policy. It's been well established. It's been a history of rulemaking by the board to balance the needs of maintaining economic viability along with natural resource protection. It's not an easy job, but it doesn't mean that you get to put the thumb on the scale either for the economics or for the environment. It's a very tough situation, but that's what you've been charged with by the legislature. So today you'll hear a lot of, potentially hear conversations about being extremely conservative or extremely precautionary or doing whatever is necessary or giving the benefit of the doubt. That does not meet legislative intent. Thank you very much.
All right, so what I'd like to do just for a few minutes with the board is talk about a recap of the October 27th field tour and get people, more members, sense of how it went and what they'd like to hear next. I just want to remind everybody what the purpose of the board tour was to get everybody up to a certain base information level on how water typing occurs today. Under the current rule and current board manual guidance, I think it is the public comment from Mark Goudier is well considered. And my intent, as things become ready to policy and as appropriate, that we should have ongoing discussions about different aspects of water typing and the different concerns that are being considered at policy over the next year, so that we are better prepared to make decisions next November when policy is due to make recommendations. So that's my thoughts. And I just wanted to open it up now for board members to have any further comment. Board Member Catherine.
Just briefly, I think as kind of the newbie on the board, it was a really good opportunity for me to kind of actually get boots on the ground and kind of get a sense of in real life what I've been reading about in some of the manuals. So I just wanted to thank staff. I thought it was a great opportunity to get out there and meet some new folks and kind of get a real sense of some of the stuff that's happening. I don't think there's any replacement for the boots on the ground experience. And so just a thank you to the chair and thank you to the staff and also the comments from the public and how we might be able to integrate that into stuff moving forward. So thank you.
Board members, we need to.
So I wanted to echo Patrick's thanks. It makes a huge difference. I thought it was a really good illustration of being able to not just see words on the paper, but see what it really means out in the field. And it was a good bonding experience. I mean, for all of us to be able to be out there together and get to know each other a little bit more in the context of these decisions that are going to be difficult as we go on. My one, I did hear frustrations from some members of the public of not being able to speak, and so my one recommendation would be the next time we have a board field tour is to allow for, you know, even right at the end, you know, for a few minutes of folks that are not members of the board and not being our staff to be able to make comments as they see fit. I would have enjoyed or appreciated hearing from members of the public, so that's my recommendation.
Any other comments from board members?
If I could, Chairman.
Well, go there.
I really appreciated the opportunity to be out there, and I think that what I saw was enlightened me in many ways about the efforts that are being made to keep a vibrant timber industry going, and at the same time realizing how important it is to use our manual and to work with within the constraints of the environmental community. Also, I just really appreciated the opportunity for that tour, and also the opportunity, the possibility for the small landowners to have a similar tour down the road to show, to illustrate what we're up against as far as small landowners.
I will just share the thanks. I also really appreciated the chance to get out and walk around and see in the field some of the challenges and some of the issues so we can better understand the differences and how we might work through those. And then I would also say that following the tour, I heard from some landowners on the east side really hoping that we might have an opportunity to work on the east side as well.
Anyone else? Board Member Herrera.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I enjoyed going on the field trip. It reminded me that when I was a much, much younger person, I did a lot of that kind of work as and as a habitat technician. We weren't necessarily doing water typing, but we were out in the streams measuring much of the same and documenting much of the same characteristics that you know, we looked at on the tour. So I really almost forgotten that work I used to do. So it was good to be reminded of it, and it'll make it easier for me as we move forward in making some decisions this next year. And the other element I enjoyed was when in our van, we had several DNR staff folks, and so we were able to then listen to a discussion between the staff about how they further do their jobs of looking at applications, looking at maps that might help them to call out areas that the people who submit the applications may not have identified as well. And I thought it was a good reminder of what the staff people do as well, that I guess they hadn't thought a lot about either. So I just thought overall it was a great trip, and I'll look forward to our next field trip. Thank you.
I'll back on a bit on what Dave said. Mr. Herrera and Mr. Gunther is the one. I think it's always better to discuss issues when you're standing there on the ground looking at them. And with the example of the small landowner template or proposal coming up, as well with all the other issues, I just encourage more of it.
Any comments from the board members? Well, if I could, I'd just like to illustrate that I'm probably the oldest person at this table.
and grew up in Lewis County and on a lot of those small streams, and I guarantee you there's a lot more cutthroat in some of those small streams than there were when I was a kid. And when we talk about 14 fish take on the electrofishing, a kid down in Brooklyn, 12 years old, will probably take 20 times that in the summertime to the fishing pole.
Board Member Sadiq.
Just one quick thing. I don't know if I heard acknowledgement of landowner staff, and Claudine specifically did a great job. That was a lot of explaining that she had to do out in the field, so I just wanted to thank her as well.
Yeah, I thank you for mentioning that. I'd like to thank both Claudine and Blake, and then of course all the DNR staff that helped with logistics as well as running the tour. Okay, so all comments noted. Let's move, and particularly since we have publics that are coming a long way, let's move to public comment under Board Manual Section 16 on unsealed slope. Okay, Ken Miller.
Good morning again, Chairman Bernath and members of the board. I'm still Ken Miller, a typical small forest landowner with very little understanding of this complex, unstable slope issue. I'm betting that at least some of you on the board are similarly unable to comprehend or totally in the dark on the fine print in this guidance. Unlike the following, or the folks following me, the brief point I wish to make is that this is a classic example of why those negotiating forest and fish established the Small Forest Landowner Office within DNR to provide technical assistance. Assistance we had for a brief moment before the budget cuts essentially eliminated all technical assistance to small forest landowners. It is true there is some support for unstable slope issues in the forest repair and easement program for smalls, in theory, but not in practice. Details I'd be happy to share in another setting. Technical assistance envisioned in forest and fish would help us with these less common unstable slope issues, but also more frequent issues such as the stream typing noted in my earlier comments, where technical assistance could help reduce the small landowner non-compliance rates. WFFA is eager to join DNR and others we know want to help with any legislative efforts that would help the Small Forest Landowner Office provide the technical assistance needed for increasing complex processes to benefit small forest landowners, increase compliance, and most importantly, to ensure our harvest activities protect the public resources as intended. Stewardship foresters, like conservation district foresters, really have our trust and confidence. Their white hat approach is far more effective than complex guidance like this that very few small forest landowners understand or will ever understand. We look forward to working towards our common interest. Thank you very much.
Carl Whitaker.
Good morning, Chair and Board Members. My name is Cara Whitaker. I'm a Senior Scientist and Policy Analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center and representing the Forest and Fish Conservation Caucus. I participated on the stakeholder group that worked on Phase 2 of the Board Manual revisions for estimating landslide runout and delivery potential, and I thank all the other group members for their participation. Throughout both phases of this process, the Conservation Caucus supported a precautionary approach consistent with the intent of both the Forest Practices Rules and what we believe is the intent of this board,
to minimize the risk to the public and public resources from landslide hazards resulting from forest practices. This approach is the most appropriate because in the face of scientific uncertainty, land management decisions that err on the side of caution will best protect the environment and public well-being. Despite many hours of discussion and negotiation, the stakeholder group was unable to reach agreement on a number of key sections that directly address minimizing potential risks to public safety. Unfortunately, we believe policy member participation in phase two obstructed the ability of the qualified expert group members to revise the manual consistent with the best available science and a precautionary approach. The Conservation Caucus's November 5th letter to you describes each of the following inadequacies and omissions that many geologists agree may put public safety at risk. One, ambiguous, weakened, and omitted language that a couple other folks have testified to today. Two, unclear guidance on landslide activity level and reactivation potential from phase one. Three, complex or composite rotational deep-seated landslides like the one that occurred at Oso, which this section was completely omitted. Four, landslide assessment decision pathway, also omitted. Number five, shallow rapid landslide core screen, omitted. And six, methods for deep-seated landslide runout assessment, also omitted. Until this board formally defines what level of risk to the public is acceptable, our caucus has maintained that a single landslide hitting a house or other public infrastructure is unacceptable. Applying a precautionary approach based on the best available science to landslide identification and runout assessment is the best way to achieve this goal. And fulfilling the requests outlined in our caucus's letter will get us much closer to meeting that goal. Please postpone the adoption of the proposed board manual and direct the DNR in collaboration only with caucus-appointed qualified expert geologists to further revise the board manual to address the multiple inadequacies referenced herein and elsewhere. Unlike the adaptive management program, the board manual revision process does not require stakeholder consensus. Thank you.
Paul Kennard.
My name is Paul Kennard. I'm a licensed geologist, hydrogeologist, and engineering geologist, and I strongly encourage the board to adopt the core screen to the manual. It is a science-based method to estimate runout from landslides, from shallow rapid landslides, and it's also an accurate, easy-to-use tool, and it's designed for use by practicing foresters with little or no geology background. I've been working on forest practices for over 27 years, and 12 of those years were spent full-time in the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Program. While there, I helped develop watershed analysis, and I co-authored the mass wasting module. I also developed descriptions for the rule-identified landforms that are in the current stability landslides, landslide rules. Additionally, I'm a consulting geologist dealing with forest practices. Much of the time, I look at impacts of landslides on private property and dwellings. In the 1990s, while I was examining damage to oyster beds from a debris flow that started at a forest road, I noticed there was a continuing landslide hazard from perched fill on the logging road. And using the same methods that are in the course of screening that we're proposing, I realized that a new debris flow from the road could impact a house down on Debab Bay. I talked to the homeowner explaining what I was doing and that I urged them to get a geologic analysis. At minimum, I said, if we have a really big storm this fall or winter, I strongly urge you to go to a motel for a couple of days, if nothing else. New Year's Day, 1997, there was such a storm, and a debris flow from the road hit the house. The homeowner died. Since then, the idea of landslides and public safety has been very real to me. Currently, I'm a geomorphologist for the National Park Service at Mount Rainier National Park. While I'm testifying on my own today, at the park, I'm frequently asked to make determinations of whether areas are safe for the public from geohazards, particularly landslides, floods, and debris flows. Just this summer, we had two debris flows that closed public roads. It's unthinkable to me that these life and limb calls would be made by someone without a geologic background. To assess public safety from landslides from forest practices, I strongly encourage the board to do the right thing and to adopt the core screen. It's easy to use, it's repeatable, and its scientifically based methods have repeatedly been verified in Washington State. I truly believe this is the least that the board can do to protect the safety of the citizens of Washington State. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Chris Mendoza.
Hello, good board. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak in the board manual section of public comments. I'll try to be a little more clear this time around. And, been a bit under the weather. So, first of all, I'd like to, again, I guess, re-emphasize what Kara's testimony pointed out to potential risk to public safety. I think most of us in this room are used to addressing public resources, sediment, water quality, potential impacts of streams and fish in streams. This issue is unique to the extent that it landed here really on the public safety issue after the landslide that occurred in the Osceola Hazel landslide. So when Carr and others mentioned that the precautionary approach is taken, I think what they need, and as you heard me testify before, that without any guidance from the board or anywhere else on how to define risk to public safety, we just presume that one landslide hitting a house, as she said, is one too many. So again, in the face of uncertainty, scientific uncertainty, the presumption is that you will be precautious in your approach to forest practices. Until we hear otherwise, there really, in our opinion, is no other way to address it. Secondly, one of the things that she omitted I'm going to speak to specifically is, excuse me, our glacial deep sea landslides referred to as complex. A landslide of this type was the very landslide that, the Hazel landslide that struck Osceola. We had an expert who works for King County come to the board manual committee and speak to us about these landslides. She wrote up a section for the board manual on how to identify the potentially most dangerous ones. They put a lot of work into it. They've used advanced remote sensing techniques such as LIDAR, as you, I think you got a handout on a LIDAR image earlier. And basically her section just says, look, if you have this tool, here's a way to use it. And here's a way to identify where the most dangerous ones could potentially happen. This section was omitted. Secondly, since DNR has recently acquired, I think it's $4 million from the state legislature, driven at this very purpose to identify where the most potentially most dangerous landslides occur, similar to the one in Oso, her piece fits perfectly with directing folks that have access to LIDAR, whether now or in the future, on how to use that remote sensing technique to identify these landslides. So again, we implore the board to not adopt the board manual without reinserting some of the critical omissions to help reduce the risk to public safety. Thank you.
Dave Bowman.
Good morning again. I'm Peter Goldman, and I'm still the director of Washington Forest Law Center. Three experienced forest geologists, one of whom was awarded a MacArthur Genius Award and is among the most respected and published geomorphologists in the world, have submitted letters and declarations to this board that Board Manual 16 is insufficient, misleading, and could pose a serious public safety risk. These scientists provided at least seven well-documented reasons summarized in our letter to the board why Board Manual 16 fails to identify potentially dangerous landslides. They wrote that 16 fails to apply the precautionary principle, fails to utilize state-of-the-art mapping and geologic resources to identify landslides, and that it fails to require geologically credible field survey methods and techniques that simply delineate landslide boundaries, measure the potential of destabilization, and estimate runout path. Our caucus has urged you and is urging you not to adopt this board manual today, but instead to postpone its consideration until the board's February meeting. And we also request a remand direction that DNR should only permit a panel of neutral geologists to participate in rewriting this board manual. I'm sorry, Mr. Godbout and the Weyerhaeuser Company whom he represents. Sound science, precautionary principle, thorough geologic investigation, and estimation of risk are and should be the cornerstones of the board manual and the forest practice regulations addressing public safety. The board manual should not and must not be the product that was supposed to be science-based but quickly got bogged down by industry attempts to weaken its term and blunt its effectiveness, jeopardizing public safety to maintain quote-unquote industry viability, which is a tenuous connection right there, is not within the legislative intent, certainly not any legislator who wants to be reelected. I'd like to now address the anticipated argument that our requested additions to or concerns about the board manual cross over into rule as opposed to being guidance. They do not. DNR undisputedly has the authority to screen forest practices for those proposed on or adjacent to steep and unstable slopes and to determine whether these practices might destabilize something and deliver in a way that would threaten public safety or public resources. This authority is best reflected in DNR's own action. Before the board even adopted a rule confirming its authority, Commissioner of Public Lands Peter Goldmark adopted a rule confirming DNR's authority to request a geologist report any time a forest practice was proposed on or near an unstable slope. DNR has the authority to require landowners to scientifically prove their proposed logging on steep and unstable slopes is safe. It is as simple as that. Nothing about that is rule. We're talking about screening, we're talking about enforcement, and we're talking about doing it right.
Can you please summarize?
Finally, I'd like to address the argument in 10 seconds or so that the manual is good enough and that DNR needs to get on with training. True, perfection is not, it should not be the enemy of the good, but this manual is nowhere close to good. And consider the circumstances of delay. As I said earlier, it was between 2007 and 2014, the Tragicoso slide, this board and its adaptive management process did nothing on forest practices that result in landslides. Nothing. 7 years of nothing, despite a lot of our requests. And now, all of a sudden, at this last minute, you're being asked to adopt the board manual that all these geologists say is not worth the paper it's written on? What is the hurry to take 2 more months, 3 more months,
Mr. Goldman,
and get it right? Thank you.
Wyatt Goulding.
Good morning, members of the board and Chairman Burnett. I've spent hundreds of hours in litigation focused on the function of the board manual, particularly in the channel migration zone context. And I was also counsel on a recent appeal referenced the North Zender appeal, so I have some experience with the application of the former board manual, the steep and unstable slopes. Peter talked about the board's authority to promulgate a board manual. My comments today concern the dilution of forest practices board manual language referenced by Chris Mendoza earlier and by Paul Kennard. And that's what the concern I hear from our scientists is that in order to be effective, a board manual has to have clear instructions. It needs the benefit of step-by-step screening tools, a standardized precautionary approach to assessing risk. That's particularly true where you have non-geologists applying it. And what I provide you today with is my opinion. I recognize you have your own attorneys, but we don't know what they're telling you. So my opinion, which is that the board manual absolutely can contain advice. Under your regulations, it is an advisory technical supplement. That's the nature of advice. It tells you what you should do. And you can just look to the rest of the board manual for proof. It contains the word should 287 times and must 143 times. And if you look through it, in every other realm, there is a tool, there's a screen, flow charts to look at a natural feature, identify it, and apply the rules to it. And that's the main thrust of what the other speakers have asked for. Now, what I've heard from our representatives is that the main reason most of this language was taken out was that there was concern from some stakeholders that if a board manual is too prescriptive, it would be used against landowners and industry in court. And I'm not sure whether they're concerned about FPA challenges or tort liability. But in either event, avoiding liability when there's mistakes is not a valid legal reason or legitimate policy reason to water down guidance. What we should all want is a system that's fair, accountable, where everyone's following the rules. And then there's something to look for to determine whether and how they apply the rules. I think that's in everyone's interest, including the industries. But to change results, we need to change behavior. Under the status quo, logging has led to landslides, it leads to landslides, landslides hurt people. We know that. And so if we want to change that, we have to change behavior, we need to make application better. And that's what everyone wants with a better board manual. So please be careful, let's get this right, let's value people's lives utmost. Thank you.
Lisa, Redlington.
Thank you, Chairman Burnett and board members. For the record, my name is Lisa Remlinger, and I am with Washington Environmental Council. While these issues are still relatively new to me, WEC has a long history of working on steep and unstable slopes. The brief point I'd like to make today is I would like to acknowledge and thank staff for the time that they have spent working through the board manual. I know that the department and industry and our caucus has put literally hundreds of hours into this. And I can understand when that much time has been spent on something that when it's not seeming to come together, there is a frustration. And it might even feel like we're doing the right thing. Maybe if everyone's a little unhappy, it's accomplishing something. But our community feels strongly that after we've heard from the amount of scientists that we did with their reasoning, not from environmentalists, but from scientists with their concerns, feeling that we need to do more, our community and WEC feels like a solid path forward would be to ask the board to postpone the vote for a short period of time to continue working through things. Thank you.
Holly Kuhn, are you?
I am going to testify again, but can I go after Max?
Sure.
Thanks.
Max Duncan, please. Thank you for being patient with us.
Honorable members of the Forest Practice Board, for the record, my name is Max Duncan. I am a small forest land owner. I live under the recently proposed North Zinder timber sale, and I am here to ask you to not approve adoption of Board Manual 16 as written. I woke up recently on the morning of the first big storm of the fall. It was the kind of morning when I know sheets of water will be moving down the side of the mountain above me. Low spots run full and the streams turn brown. That morning I woke up, learned that the DNR had withdrawn their application for the North Zinder timber sale, and I walked to the elementary school that I teach in, 750 feet from the toe of the previous deep-seated slide that roared down the slope of Sumas Mountain above, where I also live. I'm about as local to that slide path as it gets, and I'm fortunate to spend most of my days this time of year with 430 citizens of the fine state of Washington, all under the age of 13, and all under that mountain. I'm not going to speak to the science of the proposed manual, although I do teach science in that school, and urge the board to consider the written opinions of David Montgomery, Paul Kennard, and Dan McShane, who actually are scientists, and know what they are talking about. I'm going to speak to the public trust members of this board share with school teachers. You and I share a responsibility to the citizens of this state to provide a service. I provide an education. You provide guidance to practices that actually fund a part of that education and other valuable resources in our communities. We also share a trust to do our jobs in a manner that protects lives and community. Do the proceeds from 100 acres of the North Zinder timber sale pay for the risk to lives, homes, a school, wells, habitat, fish runs, a fish hatchery, a state highway, and the surrounding community if we do not have a method of assessment that uses the tools of science to adequately assess risk of catastrophic slope failure? In schools, we take time out of instruction to practice earthquake drills, fire drills, and lockdown because we understand the rule of risk to life and limb sometimes take precedence above the usual business of our day. When I was an elementary student, we didn't have to practice lockdowns because school shootings didn't happen. And the last time most of the slopes above my house were logged, there wasn't a school in that field or 90% of the homes on that road. In those days, we didn't know storms are projected to become more extreme over the next 50 years, bringing more precipitation to unstable slopes, and we didn't know there's a record of significant fault lines all through our region threatening to further destabilize slopes in critical areas. We know that now. Our knowledge of the world has changed, and what is required of us has also become different. In closing, I was struck by a sentence in a memorandum from the Forest Practices Policy and Services section requesting approval of revisions to Board Manual Section 16. It says, quote, guidance for deep-seated landslide runout is not discussed because the complexity of movement and triggering mechanisms do not allow for simple predictive models. This sounds a lot like we're not going to address the problem, because the problem is difficult to address. But predictive models do exist. We've heard several scientists say that. And ultimately, the lives of the communities who live in and around our forest depends on the complexity of that science. I teach in an elementary school at the toe of a slide, and I live in that community. I see 430 reasons every day that say utilization of the predictive models available is not extreme, but in fact, our responsibility. Please send the manual back to address this complexity and in so doing, protect our safety. Thank you.
Dr. Swanson.
Board members, Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Heather Swanson. I live on Sumas Mountain below the north end of Timbersdale. The results of this sale could have been catastrophic, and it should not have taken a nonprofit watchdog group and a lawsuit to point that out. I'm here today to ask the board not to approve the manual as currently proposed, and instead to adopt a manual based on science and on a cautionary rather than a revenue-seeking approach to logging on steep or unstable slopes in the state of Washington. In an October 12th memo to the board, Mr. Ratcliffe points out that deep-seated landslides, Max also referred to this quote, will not be discussed because the complexity of movement, et cetera, does not allow for simple predictive models. During the permit application process for the North Zender timber sale, a DNR field geologist described the deep-seated landslide above our community as, quote, relatively stable. And Mr. Bernath is quoted in yesterday's Seattle Times stating, we don't think there's anything major missing from the manual. As someone who worked at OSO after the landslide and who recently spent the time and resources to appeal a timber sale laid out on a deep-seated landslide above our community, I take such language very personally. In an age when we can see the bones of the earth with LiDAR imaging, complexity is not an excuse for business as usual. And at a point in time when the climate is changing on a geologic scale, at a point in demographic history when there are more people than ever before living on the forest-suburban interface, relatively stable is not language that should greenlight a timber sale above a community and an elementary school. And at a point in our very local and very personal history, as we recover from the OSO landslide, I look at the board manual and I see that there is something major missing. What is missing throughout the manual, and it seems to me throughout the culture of this board, is language that brings forest practices in this state out of the past and into the realities that face us today. Language that puts the safety of people like me, like the other Sumas Mountain people here today, and like the residents of OSO, that brings us to the forefront of any discussion of logging on steep or unstable slopes. Thank you very much.
Holly Kuhn.
Chair Brunath and members of the board, thank you for this opportunity to address you again. In the ongoing discussion of Board Manual Section 16, I'd like to draw your attention to a reoccurring and what I consider false dichotomy that's often raised in discussions of risk management, and that is to pit a precautionary approach against economic vitality or viability. As policymakers, it's your job to manage short-term risk, long-term risk, and perceived risk in an environment where our scientific understanding of all types of risk is changing rapidly. Increased incidences of large or catastrophic weather events and exponential increasing of the urban interface with the forest land environment and better technology and tools such as LIDAR that if used routinely can illuminate underlying risk in a detail never before available to decision makers all make risk management different than what we've done in the past. As a previous speaker pointed out, part of the Forest Practices Board mission is to maintain a viable timber industry. But I think in this conversation, it's important to ask yourself, what does viable mean to you, and at what cost? In the case of the North Zander timber sale, 2 miles of road were reopened and resurfaced, culverts were replaced, new road construction was planned, as well as a 28-foot stringer bridge over a Type 3 stream. A survey team spent a better part of the summer following Sawyers and Swampers to survey property lines in preparation for the sale. WFDW and DNR specialists spent multiple days on the ground checking the FPA boxes. How many tax dollars do you think were spent on these activities? As the owner of a half-mile-long steep gravel driveway, I shudder to think just how much was spent on gravel alone to resurface that road, let alone the rest of it. And all for an intended sale of a total of 100 acres of, I'm sorry, I grew up out in the Olympic Peninsula in the days of one log loads of old growth Douglas fir, crappy alder maple and cottonwood. Is this an economically viable model? Is this the viable timber industry you're insuring? And here's the real kicker. If the DNR had taken a precautionary approach, the only tax dollars that would have been spent were a few hours of wages for a forest geologist to look at the LIDAR or at the database of predetermined potentially dangerous landforms. All that money, all that time, and I contend we ended up with an outcome, not because of sound scientifically based public policy, but because the DNR was faced with a potential lawsuit that offered as Exhibit A, that LIDAR image I presented earlier, you know, the one that even a street urchin in Calcutta could interpret as a timber sale on a deep-seated landslide directly above an elementary school. That's kind of a public relations nightmare, I think. How many tax dollars could have been saved by initially taking a precautionary approach? I urge you, as you consider the Section 16 of the Board Manual, to not get sucked into the false dichotomy of precautionary approach versus viable economic systems. They're one and the same. Thank you.
Mark Dillon.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members, board members. For the record, I'm Mark Domet, the Executive Director for the Washington Forest Protection Association. My comments today are about Section 16 of the Board Manual on guidelines to evaluate potentially unstable slopes and landforms on forest lands. Like all of the 26 sections in the 402-page Board Manual, the goal of Section 16 is not to contain new rules or impose new requirements. Instead, it is an advisory technical supplement to the forest practices rules. First, I want to thank all of the caucus stakeholders who have participated in the Board Manual rewrite in the past year. The Environmental Caucus, the State Caucus, all of the technical experts from all of the stakeholders, including my own, who have contributed to this effort. It has been a long, long, hard effort. Our collaboration, which is not easy among stakeholders, is very important to strengthening the rules and our guidance. It is clear to me that all of the stakeholders have contributed to this document and its many changes since the Tier 1 and Phase 2 of this over a year ago. The WFPA supports the approval of the Board Manual as presented by the DNR staff. The Board Manual is an important tool for forest professionals and the vast majority of provisions in the Board Manual have consensus among the stakeholders in the caucuses. The parts that don't have consensus have been left out. We as an industry need an updated board manual on the unstable slopes so that we can do the appropriate training and outreach to our field people with clarity on how the rules should work. We have rules in place that help us identify and avoid unstable slopes, and this guidance will help us train to those rules. Our unstable slope rules have been developed to avoid any increased risk over natural background rates caused by forest practices on high-risk sites at landscape scale. The rules apply when it is determined that forest practices may contribute to the potential of sediment and debris delivery to public resources or cause a threat of public safety. They apply to public safety. Forestry in Washington State as a land use with the current rules is assisted by guidance. Forest landowners must meet a very high legal standard with no increased rates and magnitude of instability on high-risk slopes from forest management. The rule process and this guidance manual are based on sound science, and this manual represents a good step forward to provide clarity on how the rules need to be used by our professionals in the field, by the state, by the landowners, and by all of the stakeholders. I want to thank all of those who participated from all of the caucuses that worked on this over the past year, year and a half. And I especially want to thank the DNR for their staff work and the difficult time it is to juggle between sometimes conflicted stakeholders. Please support the passage of this board manual.
Karen Fuller.
Good morning, Chair Burnett and members of the Forest Practices Board. Again, for the record, my name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the Senior Forester at the Washington Forest Protection Association. I just want to add a couple of comments to Mark's testimony. First, I'd also like to thank staff and the other stakeholders and other caucuses that were involved in this process. I have sat through, personally, hours and hours of discussion about issues related to unstable slopes, and as a non-geologist, I have learned a huge amount in this arena. And so I'd like to thank my colleagues that were involved in that process. I'd also like to thank staff, because it's been a very difficult process moving forward and a highly emotional issue. And they have been professional and very qualified in moving this process forward. As Mark indicated, the standard for forestry in the state is extremely high. No increased frequency or magnitude from forest activities. I'm not certain that there is another land use in the state that has to meet that standard. It is critically important that we continue to work through the process of identifying ways and methods to make sure that forest activities do not burden public resources or threaten public safety. Forest landowners in our state and other states are very concerned and want to make certain that their activities are not impacting the public. During this process, qualified experts, foresters, engineers, and others worked together on this manual and produced a very quality product. There were some elements of the manual that were not, or requested elements of the manual that were not, did not receive consensus. And in my written comments, I've got some technical responses to some of the information that was brought forward by the Conservation Caucus. But for the most part, the items that you see in that board manual have received consensus and were adopted by the group as important steps forward in providing public safety and reduction of harm to public resources. This board manual is a great assistance for engineers, forest engineers, foresters that are on the ground, and qualified experts. It provides more information. The manual went from, I think, a number of 26 pages to 86 pages, incredibly increasing the information and science that's available to forest professionals. There are more references and more understanding of methodologies. One thing that I think is really important in the quality of this board manual is that it's very readable. So not only do you have forest professionals, reviewers, regulators that can read it and understand it, but the public is also able to read it and understand it. Finally, it also covers new technologies like LIDAR. It is inaccurate to say that LIDAR or other new methodologies are not covered in the board manual because they are very well documented and covered. The additional pieces of the board manual that did not receive consensus, for technical reasons, for legal reasons, and because they were not understandable in their current form. WFPA had three criteria in terms of making decisions about how we supported provisions and moved forward, and those were those three. Whether or not there was inappropriate rulemaking in the board manual guidance, whether sound science was applied, and whether those documents were understandable and usable to our foresters and engineers. If the board manual is not understandable to foresters and engineers, it doesn't work. And so we made sure that the information was readable and understandable.
Finally,
we ask that you approve the board manual as it's written and move forward into training and implementation of this very important document. Thank you.
Okay, board members, we're running about an hour behind, and so my question to you is, we have a choice of taking a break and coming back and starting our deliberations on the board manual or going to lunch early. Is there a preference?
Lunch early is good. Could we have a shorter lunch though? So we try to make up a little bit of time. So instead of a full hour, we have 45 minutes.
I'd be good for that. Is everybody good for that?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's reconvene at 12:30.
Are we taking a break?